Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this very snowy Wednesday morning, the 27th of February. I would suggest that any snack you're going to have, you eat it right now, because after the next 2 hours on the radio, you're going to be thinking about food so seriously. First hour of our program, Michael Moss will be joining us, author of Sugar Salt Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. And the second hour of our program, it's our book club for the month of February. And lo and behold, what does the book happen to be but Upton Sinclair's The Jungle? So it should be two really interesting hours. Our guest the first hour, you may have read his lengthy piece in the New York Times on February 20th, which is also on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. The Extraordinary Science of Addictive Junk Food is the title. And Michael Moss writes, the public and food companies have known for decades now, or at the very least since a meeting in Minneapolis, which we'll talk about in 1999, that sugary, salty, fatty foods are not good for us in the quantities that we consume them. So why are the diabetes and obesity and hypertension numbers still spiraling out of control? It's not just a matter of poor willpower on the part of the consumer and a give the people what they want attitude on the part of food manufacturers. What he found in putting together his book over 4 years of research was a conscious effort taking place in labs and marketing meetings and grocery store aisles to get people hooked on foods that are convenient and inexpensive. Michael Moss is investigative reporter for the New York Times and author of the book published this month, Sugar, Salt, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He also is the winner of a Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for his reporting on the meat industry. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. I think we'll get more than a few this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to read the article and leave messages there, we love to read them, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Good morning, Michael. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, and I'm sorry about the storm you're having. I know that's a huge inconvenience for so many of your listeners.
Yes, it is for those of us who are working, but for all the school children who are listening and have a snow day, you remember what that was like, a snow day!
Yes, and the poor parents.
Exactly. What do I do about work? What do I do about everything? Yeah. Well, let's start, as you do in the New York Times article, Michael, with this meeting, and you describe it so well, a long line of town cars and taxis pulling up to the Minneapolis headquarters of Pillsbury in 1999. Who gathered and what was the meeting for?
As you pointed out, Kathleen, we all know that too much salt, sugar, fat. And by the way, we named the book Salt, Sugar, Fat because it rolls off your tongue, you know, like a nice, gooey, melted cheese sandwich. You know, we all know that they're harmful in large quantities. So I wanted to know how the processed food industry has been dealing with the increasing concern about its ingredients. And that meeting was so informative to me for two reasons. One, it was back in 1999 when obesity was still growing and looming and wasn't quite even as huge that it is today. Two, it was, you know, involved some of the CEOs of the largest food companies in this country meeting privately to discuss this issue of obesity. And then three, the protagonist, the person leading the meeting, wasn't a consumer advocate from a not-for-profit group, but he was an high-level official at Kraft. And he, in the course of this evening, laid at the feet of the food executives responsibility for the obesity crisis and pleaded with them to do something collectively to turn a corner and be responsible, be accountable for their foods, which was just an extraordinary moment to me because it shows that they knew back then. And with that, I was off and running and figuring out how they've been wrangling with this issue over the years since then.
And those words that were spoken to ears that were probably not as receptive as some thought they would be.
They were really defensive. And you have to remember that Look, these companies convincingly argue that they never intended to make America obese or otherwise ill, and that besides convenience and low cost, they include nutrition as one of their goals. But that said, I mean, they have been driving for decades to engineer the formulas of their products, knowing from their own research that when they hit the precise amounts of salt, sugar, fat, their products will send us over the moon. They'll fly off the shelves, mm-hmm. we'll eat more, we'll buy more, and they'll make more profits. And so the executives were taken aback by one of their own senior officials saying to them, in essence, hey, guys, maybe we've gone too far here on these formulations. We may have to start thinking about dialing back. And if we're going to do that, we should do it collectively so we don't get hammered by Wall Street. And I think the CEOs, their instinct was to see lost millions in profits.
Let's tell the story, because it was a whole new brand. And I've bought a couple of these, and heavens knows my son, when he was little, loved these. But I always thought I shouldn't be buying these. And we do this. I'm not a purist. But these Lunchables, which were marketed very successfully, they have flown off the shelves. They've got a lot of bad stuff in them, but they were devised to help, you know, moms who were trying to get kids off to school and pack lunches and get to work themselves, etc. So here's something convenient that's nicely packaged. Kids love them. Oh, do kids love them.
It was invented by scientists and marketers at Oscar Mayer, which was having some difficulty with some of its meat in the late 80s. People started to become concerned about salt and saturated fat content in meat, and Oscar Mayer wanted to contemporize its products, and they went through a very rigorous, long research and development phase looking for ways to repackage their primary products, bologna, etc. And in the course of that, they hit upon sort of two very remarkable psychological strategies, if you will. One, they first keyed in on the 7 o'clock a.m. hour in everybody's household, including mine. And by interviewing moms, they learned that, you know, mothers especially, but dads as well, were just describing this nightmarish scene of trying to get out of the house, trying to get the kids out of the house, looking in the fridge for a packed lunch and not seeing it, and needing help from the processed food industry. As the primary lead in the invention told me, Bob Drain, this was like a gold mine of problems and opportunities for us. And Oscar Mayer went to town. They designed the Lunchables as a really convenient way to escape that nightmarish situation. Then the next fascinating thing that happened is that they began marketing the Lunchables, and initially it was marketed to parents, especially moms, to take to work. Then they sort of shifted toward children and came up with the pizza Lunchables, which moms said, there is no way Johnny and Susie are going to eat this thing. I mean,
right.
Think about it.
I know.
A piece of uncooked, you know, crust and some cheese you add on and a tube of tomato paste. But they went to the kids, and the kids were just head over heels for it. For this reason, as Oscar Mayer people later bragged about, Lunchables wasn't about the food to kids. It was about the power.
Yes.
And they came up with
yes.
the slogan, all day you got to do what they say, lunchtime is all yours. And that was huge for kids.
That was a brilliant marketing strategy when you think
so
about it, wasn't
about
it?
The marketing of the processed food industry is utterly brilliant.
And it is so highly orchestrated. Can you please just give us an overview of how many of these products, Prego and Coca-Cola and Dr. Pepper and Lunchables, and so many of these places use highly sophisticated tasting mechanisms. They have all these engineers. They're trying to find a point of bliss, potato chips, all of that. Tell me about the scientific process of this.
Yeah, you know, these companies have pure scientists working for them whose job it is to engineer the formulas to, for their products to hit the sort of precise amounts, as I mentioned. They have this wonderful terminology. For sugar, it's called the bliss point, which is the precise amount of sugar in a product that will make you crave it. For fat, it's the mouthfeel that fat provides. Both of those things, fat and sugar, go, you know, instantly to the brain to send you signals to eat more. And then salt, companies like to describe that as the flavor burst as it hits your tongue. One of the legendary food industry consultants, Howard Moskowitz, walked me through his recent creation of a soda, a new flavor of soda for Dr. Pepper. And it was just extraordinary what he went through. He's trained at Harvard and has a mathematics background as well. The amount of effort he put into designing the perfect new soda flavor that was guaranteed to be a hit was just a marvel to behold. They tested, first they formulated dozens and dozens of variations of the flavor, adding and taking out different levels of sweetness, and then they tested it on thousands of consumers around cities around the country, and then they looked and studied the results and picked, you know, the very perfect, most popular, most appealing of those flavors. It's such a precise science that he refers to it not as inventing food, but as engineering food.
And I can remember a time when nobody drank Dr. Pepper. Now, if you look at probably 14 to 30-year-olds and others, people like the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who had it stocked all over the world, it has become an extremely popular drink.
It has, and it's been, you know, over the years, it's been a third runner-up to Coca-Cola and Pepsi. And speaking of Coke, I actually didn't intend to write about Coca-Cola going into the research for the book, but then I came across Jeffrey Dunn, the former president for Coke North America and Latin America. And his story was so extraordinary. He spoke to me for the first time after leaving Coke and walked me through the inside story of how Coca-Cola has marketed Coke to some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
Yes.
Through targeted precision marketing. They don't, for example, call their customers. They refer to them as heavy users because they know that there's an axiom in the food industry and other things as well that 20% of the people will consume 80% of the product. And when it comes to Coke, those are people who are consuming as many as 1,000 cans of Coke a year.
Ooh.
Or more. And these became the targets. And Jeffrey Dunn's story is just extraordinary. I mean, he was their chief warrior in marketing Coke, and he walks us through the inside story of how Coke did this.
But he left. Why?
Starting in the early 2000s, Jeff Dunn had a change of mind. He read a book about sugar and health that started to move him. His spouse at the time was urging him to think about maybe doing something else with his talents. He went to South America, where Coke had a huge initiative to introduce Coke to up-and-coming middle-class residents, especially in Brazil. And he was walking the barrio one day with his managers down there and just had an epiphany. And it was basically this. It's a lot of things these kids should have in their lives, but a Coca-Cola isn't one of them. And he came back to Coke and he tried to push the company toward doing some more healthy things. Water, cut back on marketing to schools, ultimately left the company, and more recently has been doing what he calls his karmic debt in order to make up for his 20 years
at
Coca-Cola.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's total genius because he joined a farm in California that makes baby carrots. And he came up with a marketing plan that sells baby carrots like junk food. He's basically taking a page, the entire playbook, from the Coca-Cola soda marketing industry and applying it to fresh, unsweetened, ready-to-eat, great crispy carrots, on the notion that this is one of the big problems in the grocery store, which is when you walk in the door, you know you should gravitate to the fresh vegetable, fresh fruit aisle, but all of the marketing and the advertising and the allure draws you to the center of the store where the heavily processed foods are. And I think health policy advocates are increasingly looking for ways to level the playing field between the highly processed foods and the stuff that all of us know we should be eating more of.
We're going to go to phone calls. We have lots of people who would like to speak with you, and we invite more. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Michael Moss is our guest. You may have seen his article in the New York Times on February 20th that's adapted from his book, which is published by Random House this month, entitled Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. And it is quite a story. Michael is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and he won a Pulitzer in 2010 for the reporting that he did on the meat industry. So join us, won't you? Talk at WPR.org or go to our Facebook page where you can read his article and also leave messages, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Wednesday, it's our book club for the month of February. Russ Castronovo, who has been guiding us through wonderful selections, he's a professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison, will be hosting Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. And as it turns out, Russ edited the Oxford edition that we've been reading and also wrote the intro, so he's very familiar with this book, which was, I don't know about you, I read this book in high school, and it just was so influential in my life and many lives, too, and is still read and much discussed and important in 2013. So The Jungle, hour two of our program. All right, let's go to our filled phone lines, and we start with Sam in Madison. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Michael.
Hi.
First off, thank you for your work, Michael. I haven't read your book yet, but I plan to.
Thank you.
My question is very simple. How do we strike a perfect balance between personal responsibility of the consumer and the regulation of the food industry? In other words, I think at some point the customers have and the consumers have to make the right choices for themselves, which will send a message back to the companies. And also, how do we ask our government to regulate these food industries and make them responsible for their practices as well?
Thanks, Sam.
Those are great questions. I was really aggrieved in the reporting to watch the demise of the home economics field in this country. I mean, years ago it used to be that you went through high school and even boys would take a class learning about food, how to shop, how to cook, about nutrition. That's fallen by the wayside. I think consumer responsibility is a really important issue to think about. The food industry likes to talk about people not having willpower to resist their products. So I spent some time with Nora Volkow at the National Institute of Drug Abuse in Washington. She is an expert also in food addictions, and she is convinced through the neurological work that she's done as a scientist that for some people, many people in fact, some of the most highly rich, sugary, fatty foods are every bit as addictive as some narcotics. And for them, it's impossible to limit themselves to one or two cookies, and her advice to them is stay away. The other thing she points out is that it's also, I mean, food, if you're having trouble, keeping from overeating, food is actually more difficult to deal with than a narcotics addiction because food is everywhere. It's in your face, and you need it. You can't just go cold turkey on food. So I have I've developed a huge empathy for those people who feel overwhelmed by the marketing and the formulas. I think for everybody and the rest of us, though, I think we're really at a tipping point. People are increasingly concerned about what they're putting in their mouths. And the food giants are responding. They're hearing that. Any number of these companies I write about in the book in recent years have begun dialing back somewhat on salt, sugar, fat in their products, being sensitive. The main problem for them is pressure from Wall Street. They are under intense pressure to keep their profits up. So the question of government regulation comes in. A former CEO, Philip Morris, on that matter, suggested to me that, look, Michael, I'm no friend of regulation, but in this situation, you know, it could provide cover to the food industry from, yes, you know, the ravaging people on Wall Street who, mm-hmm, again, are demanding higher and higher profits.
Well, Michael, let's go, and you write about this, to another country that did do government regulation, and that's Finland.
Mm. Both Finland and England have undertaken national salt reduction initiatives because sodium has been linked to high blood pressure. And it's at the point now in England where, you know, to the joy of the initiative proponents, when Londoners travel to other countries, they're often now complaining about how salty the food is when they come back, when they're eating food overseas, because they've lowered their threshold for salt. But one of the, you know, a curious thing or an important thing has happened at the same time, which is while they've reduced their dependence on salt, obesity is continuing to climb. Mm. And the best people can sort of figure out is that these products, including sort of the junkiest sort of snack foods, are still every bit as alluring to people, even with less salt. And so they're continuing to get the fat and the sugar and the calories in excessive amounts. And I think this really points to an interesting issue, which is over the years, the food companies have tended to address their nutrient profiles, you know, one item at a time. So you'll get a run of low-fat yogurts, or you'll get a run of low-sugar cereals, or you know, most recently, low-salt. And yet the other components will sometimes even be increased, because the bottom line is they're not going to put anything on the market they don't think people will go over the moon for. And when you consider just one of these ingredients individually and not collectively, from a public health standpoint, you're not going to achieve what probably you're hoping to.
Sam, thanks for your call. John in Madison, hi.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you for your work. Propaganda works on all of us, whether you're a little kid or an adult. It works by repetition and forming heuristics, mental shortcuts as to the value of something, like food makes me more social. It makes my mom feel like she's living up to her responsibilities. It's a way to enjoy life, et cetera. We're all sold this stuff. And to me, food addiction is just like nicotine addiction. When they cut the advertising to nicotine addiction, it went from 42% of the population to now 19%. We're losing 1,000 to 200,000 people from obesity every year, and a lot of this is food addiction. And it's shot at our kids just like they targeted cigarettes at the kids. I noticed the major thrust of their advertising now is fat, sweet cereals, fatty foods, fast foods like from McDonald's and all the other Wendy's and all the rest of them, and also sugar drinks. And now we've got this horrible obesity rate in kids. What is your feeling about targeting children, which is what they do? They teach them how to argue with their parents to go to these food places.
Michael.
Yeah, back in the late 70s, this came up actually when the FTC wanted to limit the amount of advertising that food companies and other consumer entities actually were targeting at children for one really key reason, which is that kids are so impressionable and they were then and are now unable to distinguish between advertising and reality on TV shows. The industry fought back. The FTC initiative failed. Consumer advocates are still trying to push the industry to cut back more on their targeting to kids. It's beyond TV still today. I mean, some of the marketing programs of the soda companies and the snack food companies is totally aimed at convenience stores because they know that's where kids and teenagers are developing sure. their brand loyalty. They call it up and down the street marketing, as in their delivery trucks going from one convenience store to the other, because they know if they can win a child, a teenager, to their brand, they're likely to stick to that brand for the rest of their lives. So I hear you on that targeting. You know, and it goes back to my childhood, too. I grew up on Pop-Tarts, and I went to the Kellogg's Research and Development Center and doing the research for this book, and they happened to be making Pop-Tarts at the time. And the smell brought me back
oh, Michael.
40 years to my childhood, and I wanted to just grab one. It's really amazing how smells and memory are so strong, and that's an important thing to remember, too, with the food industry. It's not just salt, sugar, fat. It's texture. It's even sound. They've done research that shows that you'll eat more potato chips if they make more noise when you bite into them.
Remarkable. Given the fact that we know that there are so many people who are obese, who are overweight in this country, that childhood onset of diabetes is becoming prevalent, that there are a whole host of health problems associated with all of these foods, I'm wondering, have the profits diminished on the part of these food manufacturers because there are a number of people who have decided they have to do something differently?
They do say they're running on small margins, and I think it's relative. Some of the smartest people out there on health and obesity, including Marion Nestle at NYU, are convinced that one of the driving forces here was Wall Street in the early 1980s, which became enamored by tech companies, Silicon Valley, and that put extra increased pressure on the food companies because they weren't making as much profit as the high-flying tech companies. And if you roll forward from that, she's convinced that you can look at the behavior of the food giants dating from that day and see that it put them into a scramble where they were suddenly paying attention to, you know, quarterly, monthly, weekly profit streams, again, under pressure from Wall Street. So it's all relative in terms of the profit margins. But yes, you have to be somewhat empathetic with the way these companies are structured. They're, you know, as hooked on their companies. They're American companies.
Sure.
And they're hooked on profits as much as we are on their products. And I think you have to understand them not as being evil entities, but that's where they're coming from. And understanding that, I think, really helps empower you as a consumer and as a public decision maker on how to deal with the situation.
Michael Moss is our guest. We have a couple lines open right now if you've been trying to get through. His book, released this month, and long excerpt in the New York Times on February 20th, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and for his work reporting on the meat industry, he won a Pulitzer in 2010. 800-486-8655 is the number. Margaret in Manitowoc. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Nice show. Thank you very much for having this on. And I really totally appreciate everything that your guest is doing and has done to bring these things to light, because, my gosh, if somebody doesn't start to expose this stuff, we're all just going to keep staying stupid and fat. So, you know, good for you. I wanted to make two remarks and then ask you to talk a little bit about something that I just learned about. First of all, admittedly, I am a 1,000-can-a-day Diet Coke drinker. Sorry, but I'm so addicted I cannot leave the thing. So what am I going to do? Second of all, you were talking about the way grocery stores are laid out to take you directly into these, you know, foods that we really should not be spending that much time eating. Where I actually live, we have four grocery stores. One of them is 9 years old, one is 6 years old, one is 4 years old, and one is 1 year old. They all take you directly from picking up your cart to going directly into the produce department. Amazing. You don't even see the rest of the food when you enter the store. You see only the produce. Until you turn the corner, you don't see anything else. If you don't like the way your grocery store is laid out, that it takes you into the food you shouldn't eat, find a different grocery store. And I think that you can remark on it, to somebody to an end time. I think if enough people, complain about the layout of the stores, maybe they'll remodel it and do something about it. And then my third thing is, recently I just heard about this a little bit, and you probably know more about it than maybe anybody else, and that's the thing about the genetically modified wheat from 40, 50 years ago, that's now we're just starting to learn the unintended consequences. That wheat, and I would love to hear more about that as I am allergic to wheat.
All right, Margaret.
I'm going to take my comments off here.
Thanks, Margaret, for the call.
Thank you so much. I have to pass on GM because I haven't done the research and reporting to inform myself on that. I apologize, and maybe that's my next reporting subject. It's really interesting, the layout of the grocery stores, and in my book and talking about it, I've sort of, hit on, there are a few tricks you can use in shopping that I think can really, really help. Because, look, I'm by no means anti-processed food. My family depends on it to a certain extent, like everybody. But I think the sort of the key is to try to gain control over it. And there's a few things that experts suggest. One is to make a list and stick to it, because a shopping list, because the grocers and the food manufacturers are trying to do everything they can to get you to make spontaneous decisions. And while you might get steered to the produce aisle first, those sodas are going to be positioned on the end aisles and coolers at the checkout counter to get you to go off your planned list and buy them. I mean, the other trick is to spend more time in the produce aisle and look for fresh veggies and fruits that you can afford. And when you get to those middle aisles, boy, be really careful of the center part of the aisles. They've done studies putting these little cameras on people's eyes to look at eye movements, and we all gravitate toward the center of the aisles, eye level, and that's where the most heavily loaded salt, sugar, fat products are. With my kids, we've kind of come up with an arbitrary rule of looking for cereals with 5 grams of sugar or less per serving. The kids kind of love, because they go on an Easter egg. And they may have to look low, and I may have to reach high to find those cereals. But the great thing is they're there. Cheerios that are plain have 1 gram of sugar per serving. They love Total. I love raw oatmeal that I find actually to be not inconvenient to cook at home. So, the really good news is there are products in the grocery store that you can gravitate for and get in and out of the store with your good health intact.
And who decides on the placement? Do the food companies pay for that, or do the grocery stores just know that?
There is a little product placement issue that mostly has to do with the end aisles, or they call them the end cap. And companies will often pay for those, but generally they're of the like mind. The grocers want to sell the most popular foods, as do the food manufacturers. Where the fierce competition comes in is from brand to brand, and thus you end up with this situation where one company tries to improve the nutritional profile of its foods, and if it gets too far ahead of the competitors, boom, they will draw people down the aisle because, look, I mean, we're all drawn to the most alluring products.
Let's go to a couple emails and get your response. One from Rick in Madison. It's not surprising that the ideal product for any company is one that is both addictive and cheap to produce. Another from Mark, who says, I've heard people complain that ethanol takes away from the food supply. My reply is always, only if you think that corn syrup is food. Could you please comment on the political power of the junk food industry to maintain agribusiness farm subsidies?
One of the key things I'm hearing from people in Washington, including the White House, is that there could be a huge change occurring if the federal government could figure out a way to shift some much of the subsidies that go into highly processed foods into fresh fruit and vegetables, because the most well-meaning of us will go shopping and pay more for the foods we should be eating more of. And that's really hard for a lot of people. And yet the subsidy system is so ingrained and the food industry is so powerful, and there's that $1 trillion a year valuation of the industry that's a great influence on the Department of Agriculture and other agencies. And to move that battleship and turn it around is going to take a whole lot of effort and concern by the public and not just officials.
Let's go to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I'd like to mention MSG, monosodium glutamate, which is a neurotoxin, an excitotoxin, which stimulates the taste senses to want more, so we eat more. It's also has a long list of very adverse side effects. Now, the head of the FDA works for Monsanto, which is conflict of interest. So, anyhow, there's a website I'd like to mention here. It's truthinlabeling.org. And hopefully the listeners would pick up on this. And I'd like to hear what the guest says.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
I didn't study MSG. I know one of my neighbors is sensitive to it and has difficulty, or rather looks very carefully at labels. As you probably mentioned, the FDA and the food industry, you know, still argue that for most people, MSG is fine, and that's where it stands now on their part. I make mention of MSG for one different reason, which is besides adding salt to products, and salt is this miracle ingredient for companies, you know, you can look on the label and any number of other sodium-based additives are in there. So if you're concerned about sodium, it's not just the salt, but it's the sodium compounds that add flavor, preservatives, and have other functional attributes in processed foods.
We haven't talked very much about chips, so let's talk about chips here, because this, as you write in the article in the Times, this is amazing to me that Frito-Lay is a $3 billion a year manufacturer of Lay's, Doritos, Cheetos, and Fritos. Certainly, when I was growing up, we didn't eat I'm old, but we didn't eat a lot of chips. That wasn't our snack food of choice. But now, chips are all over the place. How have they been able to sell so many chips? $3 billion a year is a lot. And you write about the incredibly sophisticated process of making chips that are perfect, and also that baby boomers are continuing to eat these kinds of foods that people thought that they wouldn't eat anymore as they got older.
I personally love potato chips.
You do.
And one of the most telling studies that have come out recently from the Nurses' Health Study, which is one of the largest, sort of most solid pieces of research out there, is that the single item in the grocery store that's contributing most to weight gain in this country is none other than the potato chip. And I scratched my head at that. I certainly love potato chips, but what is it about the potato chip that is so alluring to people to cause them, in cases, to overeat? And the reason is that the potato chip has all three of the pillars, the holy grail, if you will. It starts with salt, which, of course, they're coated with, and that hits your tongue and sends signals to the brain called flavor burst, which gets you to eat more. We all know they're loaded in fat as well, which has twice the calories of sugar, and again sends signals to the brain that this is great, eat more. But what I didn't realize, and what most of us don't know, is that potato chips are actually loaded with sugar. And it's not added sugar necessarily, although some brands will have a little bit in the ingredients list. It's the starch of the chip, which gets converted in your body to sugar starting with the instant it hits your tongue. And so in the chip, you have the most perfectly alluring product probably in the grocery store. And beyond the chip, items like Doritos and Cheetos have other amazing attributes of texture. Vanishing caloric density is a term that I love from food scientists. It basically says these items will melt in your mouth and your brain will be fooled into thinking the calories have vanished, and thus it won't send signals to you, hey, Michael, you've eaten enough here, back off. It's fooled into thinking you're eating celery instead of these wonderful creations of snack food.
Oh, Michael, you know what? You could do a commercial for potato chips.
Well, I just love talking to these scientists because they're so into their work. And look,
right.
A lot of these people too, you know, invented these items at a time when our dependence was much less on processed foods. And over time, a number of the people I write about in the book have had to come misgivings about their work because of our growing dependence on the foods they invented. Mm-hmm. And people like Jeffrey Dunn, of course, have come full circle or now trying to make up for what they did. But even some of the snack food, one of the early leading scientists at Frito-Lay was pushing the company back in the 80s to cut back on its usage of salt. I met with him for the book. He's now, you know, and he served me for lunch plain oatmeal and raw asparagus.
Really?
Like so many food company executives. He pays really close attention to foods that he eats and doesn't eat the products of his own, in his case, former company.
Oh, so what do you do about chips? I mean, it's silly to deny ourselves something like this all the time. Or do you do that, or you just be careful about how many you eat?
Well, I don't deny myself. I think one of the things is to empower yourself and know what sort of is in the bag of chips. The other deceptive marketing practice that happens with chips is that typically the nutrition fact box, the small print on the package, will be limited to the amount of nutrient loads in a single serving, an ounce of chips. And yet so many of us will open the bag and find it impossible to stop at one serving. I mean, think about the famous Madison Avenue slogan that Frito-Lay came up with, bet you can't eat just one, sheer brilliance for its utter truth. And one of the things that the industry is grappling with now is, shouldn't we be telling people how much nutrient load is in a more reasonable serving size, including the whole bag, because so many people will sit down and eat the whole bag and be fooled into thinking they're getting far less calorie and fat and et cetera than they are. So it's not, I mean, knowledge is power. I mean, ultimately, we're the ones deciding what to buy, what to eat, and that's a hugely empowering situation, I think. If you can, again, understand, as I hope this book helps to tell people, you know, everything that food giants are throwing at you.
The author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, published this month by Random House. Michael Moss is our guest. He worked on investigating all of this for 4 years, and it's fascinating and important as well. Michael is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and his long excerpt from the book is in the February 20th edition of the Times, and we also have that on our Facebook page. You'll find it extremely interesting reading. The Facebook page place is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Mike, thanks for your call. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this snowy Wednesday, we will be doing our book club for the month of February. And it's a book that made a huge impression on me when I first read it in high school, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. Russ Castronovo, who has been with us for all of our book club discussions, professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He also wrote the intro and edited the Oxford University Press edition of The Jungle. So that's coming up. A couple more emails that have come in, some interesting ones. The extreme coupon emphasis and all the coupon inserts promote bad eating as well. You'll never find coupons for fruit and vegetables, only for the junk food items.
Again, you know, points to the imbalance in everything that goes into marketing, both processed foods and fresh foods. And that could be another great idea for leveling the playing field.
And this, maybe you know about this, for people who have smartphones, there's a great app for Androids called Fooducate. You can scan the grocery product with a phone, and it will look it up in a database and give you a grade, A through F, based on additives, genetically modified nutrient value, and the like. Pretty cool, says Patty.
That's so interesting. One thing to point out, too, is that the nutrient recommendations on food labels have fallen behind the recommendations by the Department of Agriculture and its dietary advice panel. So that when you're looking for, you know, the amount of saturated fat or salt you should be consuming, you should know that those numbers are actually a little higher, or rather, the threshold has dropped in recent years. And so, be careful even in reading the nutrient level. And the FDA says it knows this, and it's working to update those figures.
Hugh in Milwaukee, hi.
You know, about 100 years ago, we didn't have nearly as much processed foods, and we lived a much shorter life on average. I'm old enough to have seen all the fashions in foods. Had you gone to my school, home ec, when I was young, you would learn how eggs were good, how butter was good, how salt was good for you. There are fashions, and I think in the end, the only expert for what we eat should be our own taste buds. I've lived in China, for example, where, yeah, I had a lot of what you would call good food, and it was cheap. But I was also very happy that McDonald's and KFC were expanding, and the kids there loved it. Coca-Cola, you know, it was different. Diet Coke had a lemon in it, which I didn't like, so I drank Pepsi there. But the U.K., you're talking about U.K. cutting down their salt. Well, the U.K. was never known for good food. I mean, who thinks of Britain and food being good food?
I'm not gonna buy it on that one, or my email will go crazy from Londoners. But I mean, you raise a really interesting point. You know, much of the science in nutrition is really mushy. Because they don't do the kind of rigorous blind trials that pharmaceutical companies do. So I think a lot of our knowledge about nutrition is really sort of still winging it. And so much of it comes back to what my parents told me, which is slow down, chew your food, think about it, eat more fresh vegetables and fruit, and that seems to hold up today. I mean, everything in moderation is another thing. And I think what I'm trying to show with this book is that everything that the food companies put into their marketing and their allure can very easily throw that axiom of everything in moderation out of whack.
Thanks for the call, Hugh. We're running short on time, everybody. Deborah writes, one of my goals as a Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras a few years ago to help rural women understand why they shouldn't trade eggs for Coke. But the kids in the ads look so much healthier than their kids, they thought of it as a vitamin tonic.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. Bob is next in Mount Horeb. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I worked for a company in the 90s where we developed an oil analyzer for frying oils for one of the big potato chip manufacturers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to determine how long they could use the oil for fresh potato chips with no flavoring. And then as the oils degraded and they generated more off flavors, they would use them for the potato chips that had the stronger and stronger flavors, like Cool Ranch, then barbecue, then jalapeno. So interesting little
mm-hmm.
thing that they developed in order to be able to use the frying oils longer.
Hmm.
I just love the food science world because there are just dozens and dozens of sort of case studies like that where they've analyzed. I did want to say just quickly that, you know, there are good fats, and the latest research is showing that it's not enough to just cut back on saturated fat. You need to maintain or increase your intake of the good fats, and I think that's really important to note, and that's why the Mediterranean diet, it was just in the news recently, as having been shown to really work, and that includes lots of olive oil.
Right, right. Yeah, olive oil is good. Oh, Michael, you've been just so interesting, and thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, and enjoy the Upton Sinclair discussion. He was certainly one of my guiding lights.
Was he?
Yes,
all
absolutely.
Right. I was going to ask you that. I suspected that was the case. Michael Moss, our guest, and his book is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour. Thanks to Katie Madsen for on-air production in our snowy downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you after the news.